Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast. My name is Ben, I'm the owner of Watercolors Aquarium Gallery.
I'm Amy, I manage the retail side of the store, keeping track of inventory and making sure our customers get what they're looking for.
And I'm Charles, I'm the assistant manager and I work taking care of animal nutrition and health.
Today we have hopefully a fun topic. There's a lot of negative things going around and we do them ourselves. A lot of the lists up there are what you shouldn't do. So today we're going to switch that around and talk a little bit more about what people should do more of. And specifically, we're going to talk about some really cool fish that just don't get the love and attention that they deserve. So here at Watercolors, we kind of specialize in some of the rare and unusual stuff. And we've kind of gotten to know some of those fish that you don't see every day and gotten a new appreciation for some of those. Last time we did the top five fish you'll never see at Watercolors. Today, we're going to do the top five fish we hope you always get to see at Watercolors. Some pretty cool and exciting fish.
This is one that I've actually been really excited to talk about just because we all tend to get a little bit like serious and somber, and really why we're here is just to talk about fish because we love them and we're really excited about them. So I'm more excited to talk about something that I'm actually excited for than the stuff that you shouldn't do.
I also think this discussion will be much more representative of what happens behind the scenes. True. Like when we're arguing about what we're going to order in while we're looking
nerd
at the
outs.
Yeah, while we're looking at the list.
And hopefully we come up with some really cool inspiration for some fish. Somebody goes, hey, you know, that's a pretty cool idea. I like that idea. We're going to go around the room. We'll see how many match. So all three of us came up with our list completely independent of each other. We didn't talk about it. So let's get started.
I can start. So I chose mine as things that we've gotten in before that I was really excited about and I couldn't get anybody else excited about. things that I thought should sell really well to certain people. I get a lot of questions about fish where I'm going down the line and somebody points at something and says, hey, what do you think about that? And I say, it's a great fish. Okay, how many of them do I need to have? Well, it'd be better if you had 6 or more. It'd really be better if you had 10 or more, but you really should have at least 6. And people get a little discouraged, either because they don't want to spend the money on a lot of fish, or they only have one tank and they want to get as much variety in there as they can. So the first thing that I chose, the category of fish is more important in this case, are the territorial tetras. Personally, I keep the Pseudocalceus kyber's eyes. They are a 2 or 3 inch tetra that tend to form small territories. One that we have in here that's a great example right now is the redfin pirulina. And that fish didn't get anywhere near as much of attention as I think it's deserved. They really should be kept in smaller groups in smaller tanks, maybe a dominant male with a couple of females. They don't tend to run super expensive. They're one that we have right now that has bright orange to the back of them. A trio of them is just fine in a 20-gallon tank, but you really wouldn't want to go more than that. They tend to form small territories and have non-destructive territorial displays where they're just sort of showing at each other and not necessarily causing a lot of damage unless you have really small fish or really similar fish to them. Some of those territorial tetras for people who don't want a large school would probably be better for you than looking at a neon tetra or a hyphasabrygon, which are the lemon tetras or the serpe tetras, where you really just do better if you have more of them. That's my first pick.
That's the splash tetra, right?
That's the, yeah.
They have a really cool breeding strategy too. And I'd love to see somebody set up breeding setups for the splash tetras.
Yeah.
If you're not familiar with splash tetras, the way that they breed in the wild, they will look for overhanging leaves, leaves that are kind of just a few inches or a couple of inches above the water, and they will actually jump out of the water and stick themselves to the bottom of the leaves to lay their eggs. Once they've done that, they will hang out underneath those eggs and guard the territory until the eggs hatch. Yeah. Super interesting breeding strategy. Yeah. I like that fish.
Fish that sort of only come together to either show off, fight, or breed, they tend to develop really interesting breeding strategies like that. The kyber's eye tetras, which are the ones I keep in my tank, they form small territories, and the males will maintain a series of small dishes where that's where their nests are. They'll kind of dig out a little patch in the substrate and invite females into it and sort of cultivate several different nests at once with several different females if they can find them. That's not a typical breeding strategy. They're not just throwing their eggs everywhere. They're not just raising them in a cave. I don't know any other fish off the top of my head that breeds like either of those. It's a great group of fish.
Super cool. I like it. Good choice. All right, Charles, what you got?
Well, my criteria was very different. I am the newest member at the table to watercolors, so I haven't quite overcome being surprised by what we can get in because my experience was so formulated by what other places were getting in. So it was pretty eye-opening to me how much easier it is to get some things in the hobby than you would be given the impression of given some stores. So I tried to pick my stuff based on that. So my first choice was the Chopray Daino. That's my personal favorite Daino. They are gorgeous. They're that bright fluorescent orange and they got those blue bars on the side. Like if you want an active fish in your water column that's not going to like pick on other things,
mm-hmm.
I think that there are a few things you can pick better than that. I actually use Chopray Daino's as dither fish to things like CPDs, Celestial Pearl Daino's, because mm-hmm. they're kind of shy and they like to hang out near the bottom. But if there's something hanging out near the top that's not scared of anything, they're perfectly happy to come out. And you could easily keep a group of like 6 or 8 of them in a 20-gallon and you would not be crowding your system doing that. You'd still have room to do something else.
I remember when those fish started to make an appearance in the hobby and thinking, you know, my experience with Daino's before that was zebra Daino's and pearl Daino's, which are fine, but all of a sudden this other bright orange fish came out and they called it a Daino. It is a Daino, but it's a Daino. Gorgeous fish. Excellent choice.
And it doesn't behave quite like other Daino's, because like zebra Daino's and pearl Daino's, my problem with them is that they are nippy.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
I have never had a nippy Chopray Daino. I'm not going to say they don't exist.
Right.
But it hasn't happened in any of my tanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're less nippy than the other more common Daino's, and they're more outgoing than the other more common brightly colored fish. If you compare them directly to a neon tetra or a cardinal tetra, which also has that glow stripe on it.
Yep.
Throw Chopray Daino's in your tank and they will probably be out and about and begging for food within a couple of hours versus hiding under a rock like a neon tetra.
That's a great choice. Very cool choice. Mm-hmm. I like it. I went a little bit more obscure with my first one. The banded pygmy loach, which is, I'm going to try and get this scientific name right here. This is Micronemochilus cruciatus. So it is
cruciatus.
Cruciatus. Thank you. Micronemochilus cruciatus. Very, very cool little schooling loach. So usually when we think of loaches, we're thinking of a clown loach or a coolie loach or Sid the monkey or any of those botias or those loaches that are bottom-dwelling fish.
Zebra loach would be my first
loaches.
Thought.
Yeah. Yep, they're active fish. They're territorial fish. You should keep one or two, and they get 4 or 5 inches long. Banded pygmy loaches are loaches that act like tetras. They want to be in schools. They want to be in groups. They are super peaceful. 6 to 8 of them is about the right number. They're an egg scatterer that are supposed to be very, very easy to breed. And it's a loach that schools.
Yeah,
anyway, so that was my first pick, was the banded pygmy loach.
Well, first of all, both of those fish that you guys just said barely didn't make it on my list, so I'm glad I didn't pick both of those.
Yeah.
Honorable mention in that conversation is the rosy loach, which
absolutely.
Is similar behaviors, a little bit smaller, supposedly just as easy to breed. The reason that I have a commentary on the scientific name is the cruciatus is that species name, and this is going to be a nerdy dive in, but anyone who's been ever into Harry Potter, the cruciatus,
I knew it.
The cruciatus is basically the torture spell, right? And anybody who has ever had to catch that fish knows why they have that name. That's why
they are fast.
Once you get them in the tank, they're fantastic fish. You don't want to be the one to catch them.
Less than 2 inch maximum size, so they're great for some of the smaller tanks that people are getting into right now.
Great one.
Thanks.
So my next one is one that when I was first looking through this and thinking about what I was going to choose, I threw it on there because I thought it was a cute fish that we've never really sold that well. These are the Styphodon gobies. fantastic fish for nano tanks. Most of them don't get more than 2 inches. I think the biggest one gets 3, but long, skinny fish, so they don't take up much room. I realized that I didn't know that much about this genus. That's sort of why I ended up putting it on here, because I have a lot to say about it. There are actually 36 species of Styphodon.
There's a bunch of them.
There's a lot of fish in that genus, and most of them are from really individualized locations, as in you're only finding this one in this specific area. So the ones we know most commonly see are going to be like the cobalt, the neon, the ornate, all fantastic fish. They take frozen foods really quickly. They take prepared foods well, given a little bit of time, unless you've got some that are already well conditioned. If you get them from us, they'll already be on flake food or pellet foods. They are algae eaters, and they're a nano algae eater that isn't as stressed easily as Otocinclus are. They're not going to clean your tank of algae, but they do consume some film algae, consume some biofilm in the wild. That's the majority of their diet. What really drew me to talking about this in this context is, from what I could tell, I have never seen anybody who has bred a Styphodon goby.
Do you know why?
Yes, I do know why. So these are fish that have a really interesting lifestyle where they're born up in these small streams in these really specific locations. When they spawn, they produce something like 10,000 eggs.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, and those all hatch within usually around 24 hours, get washed down to the ocean, and then spend their time there for a few months. Before then, they have to find their way back up to where they came. This is a little 2-inch fish climbing up rapids and all sorts of things to get to where they were hatched. So a truly amazing fish, and one that habitats like that are really, really at risk of destruction. So if we as a hobby could figure out how to breed those fish to make them available for more people, I think that would be a fun project for us to try.
So I'm not very familiar with this genus. Are these like a true like gobidae goby?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do
mm-hmm.
they go through a true like larval stage like Oceania?
Yeah. Their life cycle is more similar to most saltwater fish than most freshwater fish, except for the fact that they return back to the true fresh water. And sometimes it takes them months to get back to where they came from after they reach that size where they're able to actually go back, because they could be a couple of miles away from that origin stream where they come from. This is just a little fun fact about when they hatch, they're usually still about a half millimeter. So they're teeny tinies. As nano fish, as community fish, there's not too much that they can't go with. They're not going to eat anything other than dwarf shrimp. Nothing's really going to eat them other than big fish. They're not going to get into it. You could keep one or two of them. You could keep a group of them. They're not aggressive. Just kind of great overall aquarium fish.
Cool and unique. I like it. All right, Charles, what's your next one?
So my next one is I picked Desmopuntis hexazona, which is the hexazona barb.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
This is a fish that has the body size of like a Serpe tetra, but none of the bad qualities of the nippiness that Serpe tetras can get. It's basically a cardinal tetra sized up to a Serpe tetra.
But barbs are mean, aren't they, Charles?
No, they're not. And I just think barbs just get a really bad rap
totally.
Because the domesticated strain of tiger barbs are actually hybrids. There's probably like 4 species of tiger barb in that thing at this point. And I don't know what it does to them, but it turns them into jerks.
Yeah, the closest wild form of a tiger barb is actually not a mean fish at all.
Yeah, well, Mike Manchi, he has worked with 2 wild species of tiger barbs. Neither of them causes any problems in his tanks.
Nope.
But every time he tries to bring in, well, has tried to bring in domesticated ones, they like to destroy everything.
Jerks.
I wonder if we accidentally selective bred them into aggression, not just because of we wanted them to be more aggressive, and I'm talking the general we as the
yeah.
hobby, but just because the dominant fish usually look the most healthy, they're usually out and about. Maybe that's what over the last several decades have selected as
that's
their
a
breeders.
Pretty good theory.
That's an unformed thought that just popped in my head.
Right.
But,
but you're right about the wild ones being just fine.
Yep.
Hexazonas, though.
But the hexazona barbs, they're gorgeous fish. They're kind of like a slender-bodied tiger barb that they have more of a true orange to them. They have the black stripes, but the edges of each scale, as long as they're not freaked out by something, has an iridescent emerald green, each one of them. So you get a group of like 10 of those in a dimly lit tank, and it's like green halos swimming around in your tank. They are gorgeous, peaceful. They're kind of skittish, but you're not going to have any more problems getting them to come out than you would, say, a cardinal tetra.
That's something I'm going to talk about a little farther down my list, but the representation of a fish at a store versus in a home or in an aquarium where they're established, and hexazonas are one that looks pretty good in a store. But if they've been in a tank for a little while and yep. they're comfortable, they're stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that sees my group of hexazona barbs comments on them.
And probably asks you what they are.
Yeah, they just don't really look like a lot of things we have. They are faced with habitat destruction too, but for a very different reason. They're native to peat swamps, which are popular for turning into palm oil plantations.
Palm oil.
So, make sure you know what your ingredients and things like peanut butter are, because palm oil is becoming one of those very destructive things. Think things like orangutans, things like licorice gouramis and hexazona barbs are the things living in the pools of water underneath those.
Right.
So if you can look into what you can do to protect an orangutan, you're tangentially protecting these things too.
Right.
So if you're curious on what you can do to help out these organisms, look up what you can do to help protect an orangutan.
I like it. That's a good one, Charles. I like that. I wouldn't have thought of the hexazona barbs, but...
We just need more cool. barbs in the hobby.
Yep.
At least we need more people liking barbs.
Yep, that's true. That's true. All right, so I'm going to go with another less represented fish, the Kubotai resbora. Microdivario Kubotai. One of those fish that we keep them downstairs, we put them through quarantine, and we bring them up and we put them in one of our displays because it's a rare fish that we like to show off, and we sell them out of the display because people insist on it because they're so cool. It sort of has that same kind of glow that cardinal or neon tetra gets, only instead of blue or red, it's green.
This is going to sound like an exaggeration over audio, but I swear it is not. If you told some people that that fish was a glowfish, they might believe you.
Yeah,
it's possible. It's possible.
I wouldn't be surprised if someone asked if they were a dyed fish.
Yeah.
Because they just look ridiculously green.
Yes.
Yeah. And in the wild, that's great natural camouflage. I assume that's probably why they developed that coloration.
I would imagine it looks like sunlit leaves.
Yeah.
So, well, the nice thing about iridescence is it requires light. So a fish can disappear by kind of angling itself so that the sunlight's no longer refracting towards a predator.
Oh, yeah.
That's why iridescence is so common in small fish.
Yep. But when you're keeping them under just constant bright aquarium lights, then they're always showing off like that, the way they probably wouldn't be in the wild.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Gorgeous little fish. Peaceful little fish. Does great in groups. Does great on flake food.
Mm-hmm.
Not very expensive. That's why I chose it.
Yeah. And outgoing, unlike the Sundanios.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great one. Okay. My next group is a fish that... pretty much everybody who sees them wants them in some way, but thinks that they're a lot more complicated than they are, and that's Pseudomugil rainbowfish.
Mm.
The one that we keep most regularly here is Furcata.
Mm-hmm.
I love that fish. We have a fantastic breeder for that fish, so that's probably the one you're most likely to see here. But really, anything in that genus is really cool, and most of them are very hardy. The only ones that get a little bit more complicated are the ones that need brackish environments. They are another one where you can keep them in small groups. You can see really interesting displays from them in small groups. Slightly territorial, but almost never actually damage each other in any way. So you can keep a couple of males and have them spar, and you really probably won't even see much torn fins out of them or anything like that.
Those displays can be amazing between the males.
I'm trying not to jump ahead of anybody here, but it's kind of a similar thing that it is with killifish. People look at them and they see, this is a brightly colored fish that looks like nothing else. This must be really hard to take care of, and I must not be able to afford it.
Right.
And you could do 3 Furcata rainbows in a 10-gallon tank, a trio of them. They would look pretty, they would be really peaceful with everything, and they're very hardy. The Furcatas, I think, prefer a pH around 7 to 8 and mid to high 70s for temperature, which is pretty much what we're all keeping our tanks at anyway.
At least around here,
where we do have high pH and hot, hard water, which can sometimes be harder to find fish that thrive in those environments. particularly small fish, particularly brightly colored fish, because in those tannic stained areas, they brightly colored fish show up better. Mm-hmm. But I did see a really fun thing on, this is from Seriously Fish. I was looking up Pseudomugil gertrudei, which is another one of the pretty ones. And they have Pseudomugil gertrudei recorded at a pH from, and part of me thinks this must be wrong, 3.68 to 9.4.
That's not wrong.
And a temperature from 53 to
93.
53? Yep. Now, temperature tends to be in flux like that just because the coldest non-sunny day. But 53 to 93.
That's amazing.
I couldn't take 53 to 93 without protective equipment. Could you guys?
Yeah, I get uncomfortable above like 77.
Yeah. So they're really hardy, adaptable fish. If you're getting wild caught ones, it's a little more necessary to keep them where their natural environments come from. But pretty much every Pseudomugil in the hobby is going to be captive bred.
When you mention the Pseudomugils, you got to make sure you mention Luminata. That's the really cool orange one.
True.
These guys are all the blue eyes. And the reason they're all called blue-eyed rainbow fish is because the blue on their eyes, iridescence.
Well, I'm extrapolating from the, it's fluoresces. So I imagine it would be iridescence.
It iridesces like a cardinal tetra or a neon tetra.
Yes.
And so all of those fish have these glowing blue eyes. Very cool group of rainbow fish.
And I don't see them that often. And when somebody does see them, they usually want them.
When I see them, I kind of think they're kind of creepy. They're gorgeous, but that eye is just,
it's too much for you.
It's too much for me.
I'm really glad that you brought up the whole genus because I had the Luminatas on my list.
Okay.
But I had too many fish on my list, so we already talked about them. So that was on your list.
Yeah, I definitely went way too general on some of these.
Scratch those off. And
I had a couple spots that I wanted to do an entire genus. Mm-hmm. And then I said, no, you have to pick one species.
I did an entire genus on one of them as well.
I did more than an entire genus on a couple of them. It's just hard to whittle it down to one fish. I have so many fish I want to talk about.
Well, I normally just went with probably like my favorite one of that group. So I was like, I want to put a bar. What's the one that I'm keeping now?
Yeah.
There you go. All right, Charles, what's your next fish?
I put Nothobranchius eggersi.
Nice.
Eggersi.
Because you were just talking about killifish. They are a fish that a lot of people look at and like, oh man, they're gorgeous, but they're kind of pricey, and I don't know how to take care of them, and they need a dedicated tank.
Pricey, you can get much uglier fish for more than that.
That's true. Well, and I can explain that myth that they live shorter. It's because captive strains of Nothobranchius forcii are bred to, at least in laboratories, to bred to have a shorter lifespan because they're a model organism for fast reproduction and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you want them to breed faster. So all the scientific literature says this strain lives for 6 months.
So it's not just the scientific literature about the lab produced fish. It's because in the wild, they only live for 6 months.
Yeah.
Because they live in pools that dry up.
Yeah, I guess that's true. When you don't have a pool that dries up, you don't really know how long you can keep going, I guess.
As a hobbyist, that information is more readily available to me than the scientific information. I actually didn't know anything about that, so that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. It's amazing to me how many people come in the shop and go, oh, I don't want to keep killifish because they only live for 6 months. And killifish it's such a huge family of fish with so much diversity that myth is something that we really need to work at dispelling. Additionally, the Nothobranchius species, Nothobranchius rakovii, is a fish that I have spent a lot of time with.
Oh, that's a great fish.
And I had them for 4 years. My male was 4 years old.
Wow.
In the wild, that fish lives for less than 6 months. Sorry, Charles.
You're fine. But, like, seriously, they don't, like, a lot of people think they're so complicated, and they're really not. You and I both are like, 2.5 gallons, that's enough for a pair.
Plenty.
That's more than enough. And so, like, if you can set up a 2.5 gallon that you have at a reasonable temperature and you keep relatively clean, they will trudge on for a long time be very happy.
Well, my bias against killies is that most people that I know who keep killies, they keep Achilles. They have a closet that has 102.5 gallons and 4 feet of space. And that's how they do it. And it's just them and nothing else. And mm-hmm. I've never been attracted to that side of fish keeping where it's just a breeder room. And so Achilles are something I write off completely. But a pair of Achilles in a planted 5 gallon or 10 gallon, which is the same way that people who really like domestic bettas keep domestic bettas. People who really like those singular, really colorful fish keep them. That's a fantastic tank. And it would be so easy, and they're hardy, and they'll forgive you for forgetting their water changes for a month if they need to. And more people should be looking into that as an alternative to other single one-tank fish.
I've heard of some people using East African killifish as dithers for like pelvichromis and stuff mm-hmm. because oh, sure. they can handle occasionally getting chased by something. They're yeah. like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
The Nothos don't take crap from anybody.
No, they don't, but they're gorgeous.
They're
like,
amazing.
The Egger's eyes just really mm-hmm. do it for me though because they got that crazy red and like blue thing going mm-hmm. on.
Yeah.
Well, a lot more people keep Well, from the scientific definition of killifish, keep killifish than you would think. Because killifish is such a large group of things.
That's a fair point.
A lot of live bearers in the hobby are actually a type of killifish.
I think it goes the other way, that there are some killifish that are live bearing, isn't it?
Well, maybe give us some examples and we can see where it shakes out. If you guys have one off the top of your head.
I'm pretty sure Crocodon genus is a killifish genus.
Those two groups are very close.
But
yeah.
we're talking
yes, there is some cross-contamination between them, but a lot of like what people would just go, oh, it's a live bear.
Are you talking about like the Oreisius genus or?
No. There's a group. There's actually one of the generas of live bearers that some of them are live bearers and some of them are egg layers.
Oh, interesting.
Right. And they're in the same genus, and I believe it is Crocodon. So when you're talking about the group of fish that are killifish, there are killifish that are native to Michigan, like I think three species. There are many of them that are native to the United States and the rest of North America. And I believe every continent except Antarctica has killies. We need to research that about Australia because they might not be in Australia.
I can't answer that question off the top of my head.
Yeah. I can't even say anything that would be found in, right. off the top of my head, I can't say many groups of fish that would be found in more than three continents.
Right. Did you get all that you need to do with the Nothos?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So it's the good segue into a fish that you guys all knew would be on my list.
No.
Right? The clown killifish, Epiplatus annulatus. Recently, I've even gotten a new appreciation for that fish because I used to keep killifish the way Amy just talked about how most people keep killifish. And when I kept my clown killifish originally, when I spawned them, I had them in a 2.5 gallon tank with a bunch of Java moss mm-hmm. and they were great and they spawned readily and it was a fun tank for me as a killifish geek at that point. Lately we've been throwing them into some of our cool displays with some peaceful fish and they do fantastic like mm-hmm. that. A relatively planted tank with a group of mid-swimming tetras resboras or bororas and they're gonna be just fine. They're gonna fill that surface niche, that surface position that we're always looking to fill, right? We want the bottom swimmers, we want the mid swimmers, and we want the top swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
How about one of the coolest looking fish in the whole planet, and they're gonna work great in a lot of these little micro tanks. Yes, it's one of my all-time favorite fish, so that's why I...
Well, and you gotta talk about your story and about their other name and how you actually came to want to keep them too, because I know it's your favorite fish, so you should really talk about
it. All right. Okay, so it's really a fish that got me into the hobby. I had had an aquarium when I was a child, and it had a blue gourami and a neon tetra, and it had a pirate ship and all that fun. I think it had orange or red gravel, right? I had that fish in the tank. And then I accidentally stole a book from the library. Yes, it was on accident, but I do still have it. I probably should bring it back someday, but a couple of years have gone by.
They would tell you just to keep it, because eventually you have enough fees that you have to pay for it. I've learned that from experience.
Okay. There we go. So this fish I found in that book, and in that book it's called the Rocket Panchaks. The reason it's called the Rocket Panchaks is because it looks a little bit like a cartoon rocket ship. the males, both the males and females are banded. They have these beautiful black and white bands all the way down the body. But the tail on the male looks like cartoon flames coming out of the back of the rocket. Just an amazing little fish. But anyway, when I was just starting to get into the hobby, I took that book around to a bunch of the stores and asked them, hey, I want this fish because it looks so cool. And of course, at that time, this was the late 70s, early 80s, nobody had that fish in a pet store. So it wasn't available, but I
did they have electricity at the time?
Oh, come on. That's just me. Let me get my glasses on. Anyway. So that got me into that fish. Looking for that fish got me into looking at some of the other fish in the stores and got me more into, instead of just having a pirate ship tank, having some cooler fish in my tank. So that is a fish that was very influential in my development as a hobbyist.
Great fish.
Quick comment on them. So this morning I noticed in the bonsai display, a couple of our clown killie males were displaying to the
nice.
Ladies,
aww.
Which I don't think you will get a successful spawn in that type of setup, but it's gorgeous to watch.
I don't know. That may be a decent enough setup in there. I mean, it's just them, Neocaridina, which are our live food if they're small enough, and a mass of moss. So
the babies will instinctively go to the surface.
Oh, and then just get eaten by the adults. Okay.
Yeah. Now, if we would pull that clump of moss out and put it into a different tank,
yeah.
Chances are very good we'd get some babies out of it.
Yeah, I don't think fry is impossible, but probably actual viable.
Survival.
Yeah. But we could probably get a hatch out of there if
probably.
We really fed them nice.
Yep.
It's just they just have a gorgeous display. It was
yeah.
fun to watch. That's
they're
the first
so
thing
cool.
I saw this morning.
And they do also have an iridescent eye, but it's a little bit more subtle, so maybe you'd find it a little less creepy.
Yeah, yes. No, they don't bother me so much.
Yeah. That's
cool.
All right. Well, my next fish on my list, and this could have been another group entirely too, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, but I put the Congo puffer down for one of mine.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's a medium-sized puffer, and nobody really talks about medium-sized puffers. You have the pea puffers, which are very aggressive, even though they get to an inch if you have a big one. But nobody talks about those puffers that are in that 4 to 6 inch range. You're either doing a pea puffer or a fajaca puffer, which is an 18 inch long fish. It needs to be kept in a huge tank. There are a whole bunch of puffers that could go in a 20 to 40 gallon tank. The Congo puffer, I think, is the best one because it could easily go in a 20. They're an ambush predator. They get to 6 inches long would be a large one. They're really brightly red. They still have puffer personalities. They're really weird looking. I keep a Laodon cutia. That's one of my puffers at home. That fish gets to about 4 inches, and I keep it in a 20 long. So I think single species medium-sized tanks are really underrepresented. And if you're going to do it, an under 55-gallon single species tank. You could do one of the more aggressive cichlids, or you could do a Congo puffer and have something that's a little bit cooler to me and a little bit more exotic. Most of them will take frozen foods really well. We've gotten Congos easily on that. We've gotten the South American puffers really easily on frozen foods. My Laodon eats krill. So if you want something that's more of a pet, more of a single fish, I think that's something that should be on anybody's list at least to consider.
Super cool fish. The personality of a puffer is kind of hard to beat.
Exactly.
With those goofy eyes.
Yeah, those goofy eyes, they're always watching you. And everybody loves puffers. They're adorable. So I would rather keep a 4 to 6 inch puffer than a pea puffer any day. But we've also, just the nature of our store, we just moved to a larger location. We started off in a smaller location. There were times where we needed to have more fish in than we could have individual tanks for. So we've experimented a little bit with compatibility just by necessity. So there are some puffers that are in that size range that can go in a community with other fish. The South American puffer is probably the best example of that. As long as it's things that are fairly quick and can get away, South American puffers get to about 2 or 4 inches. If it can't fit in their mouth, they're probably not going to eat it. They would rather have you feed them and then just go about their way.
And they can be in groups.
Exactly.
That's one of the cool things.
Yeah, that doesn't have to be single.
They actually like to be in groups. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, if I would have remembered it, the South American puffer would have been on my list as underrated
yeah.
fish.
It wasn't my first just because I don't think it's underrated. Everyone who knows about it thinks it's really, really, really cool.
Yeah, right.
So it's not, it's a more unknown puffer, but it's actually a better community fish than a pea puffer and bigger.
All right, Charles, your turn.
So this is the closest I came to cheating on my list. I put down Epistogramma agassizii.
Mm.
And I say that because what we now classify as Epistogramma agassizii is probably like 10 species because the current accepted range is the entire Amazon River from Peru to Brazil. There is no way that is one species.
Right.
And the genetics so far seem to back that up, but they are in, they're easily my favorite Epistogramma. I think they're way cooler than a ram or even some of the captive strains of like Cacatoides. They got that ridiculous spade-shaped tail.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what location you get them from, they come in all sorts of weird blues, greens, oranges.
Those are super cool fish.
They are gorgeous, and I love them, and they deserve way more attention than they get.
Well, and the ornamental strains, they're a slightly newer fish to the hobby, but the fire red Episto agassizii, if you really want something that is vibrant and brightly colored and a dwarf cichlid, and not an electric blue ram, or that's a great one to go for because they are just completely unique. But even, you're right, the wild caught ones, the different type localities, you could have a pretty much unique fish that's beautiful no matter where you are on that species.
There are a lot of community tanks that could actually handle a pair of Epistos.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a great, anywhere you would put a pair of rams, you could replace with a pair of Epistos.
Mm-hmm.
And anywhere you've got a tank that's got at least somewhat faster, slightly more robust tetras. I don't know that I'd want to see them with... Maybe they would be fine even with cardinal tetras.
I mean,
Ted Judy uses cardinal tetras as dithers for some of his
Epistos. I've heard of them being kept in chili rasboris tanks, and I would be really iffy on that. But like the Tucano tetra, which is a bit of a deeper-bodied small tetra...
Mm-hmm.
That should be just fine. If they can't eat it, they're gonna ignore it.
Yeah, that's true. Their little territorial nature is gonna have, it's gonna be very, very isolated to wherever their little territory is.
Yeah, just a little cave.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of
excellent
a
choice.
Wild color purist. So.
Right.
Right.
So the variety you can just get with the agassizii, that's...
Yeah, and if someone's gonna go for an ornamental, I'd rather them go for that than some of the others.
Yep.
Well, and that and the agassizii just got that distinctive profile. Like, from across the room, you're not going to mistake that for any other Episto.
That is
absolutely
an Episto agassizii.
Yep.
That's a good one.
He definitely did get a little... Charles definitely did get a little bit twitchy when Amy started bringing up the developed color morphs.
Yeah. And if I were to buy one for myself, I'd probably buy a wild, but I can't knock people for buying a gorgeous fish.
To be fair, I do have that trio of redneck McMaster eyes.
Yeah.
Mm.
They were just too much for me to pass up.
Yeah.
But I still like the wild colors more than that.
Well, those don't have the trademark. They still have a natural brownish body color. They still have, they look like they could just be a really pretty natural fish, even though they're a really pretty ornamental fish. And the fire red agassizii, you can't mistake that for a natural fish.
Yeah, and I have to admit that like my bias is a true personal bias because like most captivated varieties of things, they're just exaggerations of something that already exists in the animal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Once again, another good segue because I had Epistogramma panduro on my list.
I knew you would pick Episto panduro.
But those are probably the perfect two to have.
I know. Yeah. The males and the females on both of those fish are absolutely gorgeous. They can handle a lot of different water conditions. Actually, agassizii too. A lot of the Epistos are really specialized, and they're not going to thrive in the higher pHs that we're used to here. A lot of the agassizii and a lot of the panduros can handle the higher pH water that we have in Michigan, the harder water they have in Michigan, and a lot of places around the country. The panduro just happens to be the one I like the best. I think the colors on it are really cool. It doesn't necessarily have the nice big flowy spade tail that the agassizii has, but the colors in the tail on the panduros are my favorite. So I don't need to say much more about the panduros because the general Episto conversation we had covers it. I like the panduros a little bit better. I think they're a really cool fish. You can put them in a community tank.
And I do like the round tails.
Well,
I do too.
I wanted to just comment on that because I guess a Pandaro makes more sense to tell this story. I didn't keep any cichlids for a long time just because I wasn't interested. Epistogramma Pandaro is the episto that Ben used to convince me that epistos were cool. And then along the way, I found Agazizii's and was just like, well, I like that better. But Panduros are gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
They have, like, the males will sometimes develop that, like, lavender in the tail.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's really hard to find purple in freshwater fish.
Right.
By the way, the Kyber's Eye tetras that I talked about earlier have a great purple too.
Yeah,
those are good purple. Yep.
The other thing to say about Panduro that I think needs to be said is reportedly the easiest episto to breed. So that's a really good one to talk about for that reason too.
That's true.
If you want to get into epistos, Panduro is a pretty great one to start with.
Yep. I like it.
Yeah, I think those were both great points that didn't take away from each other at all. It's great.
Yeah.
All right. I cannot believe that I'm going to be the first person to talk about an anabantoid.
I'm surprised.
Because we are all three pretty big anabantoid nerds.
I saved the best for last.
Okay, well, I'm not going to take away from yours because I'm actually talking about Microtenopoma.
Mm.
Yeah, and there are actually 12 species in that genus. Most of them are boring brown fish, but two of them are gorgeous, awesome aquarium fish. So, Microtenopoma fasciolatum, I've kept that before. They get about 3 inches. They're really comparable to, like, a 3-spot gourami in personality, but they have a little bit more of a wild look around them. Tenopomas in general are an anabantoid. You'll probably see the leaf fish is the most common one talked about. But Microtenopoma, which is actually its own separate genus, not a subgenus, as I had heard in the past, they actually split it off. They are a bubble nester and not egg scatterers. So makes them a little bit more interesting to keep, makes them a little bit more interesting to breed. Fasciolatum is a really interesting fish. That's one that's always going to look really ugly in fish stores. But when you have them at home, they're a fish that can change their color really rapidly. So either be really dark individual banded stripes or, you know, change it on a flash to be their breeding colors or their aggressive colors. That's a really fun one. But I think the one that people are most excited about is Ansorgii. That fish has really distinct red and black bands when it's in a comfortable environment. It's also going to look a little bit boring in fish stores. They tend to brown out their stripes a little bit, but you can still distinctly see it even when the fish is stressed. And that one only gets to about 2 inches. So if you're looking at things like dwarf gouramis, honey gouramis, it fits right in the same sort of tanks that will, and maybe even a little bit smaller, because I've never seen one that's more than 2 inches.
They're such cool fish.
Yeah, and they're beautiful, great personalities, really just fish that are completely underrated in the hobby. I think more people should talk about them.
That's another one of those fish that I remember trying to find.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been more like 15 years ago. But
right.
I remember when I had my fish room and was breeding all kinds of things and what different cool fish could I get. I saw those in books and tried to find that fish and could never find it.
And it's one that we have regularly available. We've gotten it in a few times and haven't seen a lot of interest for. And I think it's a better fit for most tanks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a better fit for most nanos than a domestic betta is. It's a fit for a lot of nano tanks that have groups of peaceful fish in them. You wouldn't want to keep them with a honey gourami or a dwarf gourami because they're a lot shyer and not nearly as territorial. So pros and cons to keeping them. I prefer to keep fish that aren't going to mess with each other.
I like it. That's a very cool choice.
So I wrote down betta albimarginata,
mm.
But what my heart wanted to say was wild bettas in general.
I think you can do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you can do
at least
that.
So that we can talk about it like
yeah.
that.
Because a lot of people, they talk about betta and they think the domesticated strains, and those are all, they're technically labeled as betta splendens, but the genetic evidence indicates it's some sort of hybrid. Got betta splendens, betta smeridina, betta...
Machaconensis.
Well, some of the dragon scale varieties, that's where the iridescence comes from, is their machaconensis bright hybrids.
Makes sense.
I was trying to say imbellus.
Yeah.
Imbellus. And so there's a lot going on there, but I just listed off 4 species... And then there's like another 80 species on top of that. Like, it's a really big genus. And they have this wild range of, some of them are bubble nesters. Some of them are mouth brooders. And I really like...
Some of them do both.
Some of
yeah.
them are switch hitters. Like, but I picked Betta albimarginata specifically. I tend to well, Ben and I both tend to skew towards the large mouth brooders.
I just think they're so cool.
They're so cool.
But Alex Marginata is a pretty small mouth brooder.
It's a
compared
small
to some of the others.
Mouth brooder, which makes it more viable as something like in a community.
Right.
Like, we consistently keep it in with other fish and it doesn't cause problems. And like, we have a pair in our ellipse display and they spawn fairly regularly.
Yeah.
If you had the gumption to pull the male out when he's holding, you could spawn in your display tank and then rear in a separate tank. Like, it would be really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we've spawned them easily without really trying in our Grand Rapids 7.8 pH water as hard as liquid rock. We've never really made a point to separate them out and raise the fry or anything like that, but they spawn in that, so their hardiness is pretty up there. I don't know that we could.
I don't know that we could get them to hatch.
Probably
in the 7.8 pH.
Probably not. But they're kept just fine.
Yes.
I think we could do it. Because from what I can find in the literature, it's not a specific pH or TDS that's the critical factor. It's the bacterial load. So lower pH environments have a lower bacterial load. So theoretically, as long as you're keeping the water clean, you shouldn't have a problem getting the eggs to hatch.
Except higher pH in Michigan water also equals higher hardness, which equals higher calcium levels. And so a lot of the eggs of fish from, a lot of the soft water fish eggs, the outside of the egg can calcify.
And you're correct. I don't find evidence that betta eggs do that.
Okay. Excellent.
At least unless you're working with some of the complexes like the Cosina complex where they come from like
4.5.
Yeah.
Right.
That's documented in them, but
okay,
that isn't documented in any of the mouth brooders.
Excellent.
Well, that's really one of the explanations that we've just posited for why, if we throw a pair of fish in a tank and forget about them and don't see fry.
Right.
So maybe they're calcifying in his mouth, maybe there's a bunch of factors that if you're not really focusing on breeding something, you're gonna miss. And we don't know which that is. It'd be interesting to find out.
Because I've been breeding the Una maculata in tap water without problems, and
that's
I don't
true.
Find any evidence that like an LB should be different in that respect.
Yeah,
I just,
but the unis will, Unimaculata will come from some streams that have a higher pH naturally.
Yes.
Whereas I don't believe the Alba Marginata does. I believe that is mostly a blackwater fish.
They come from a range not as high as 7.8,
okay,
but they will get as high as like 7.2.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, well, that's the thing about mouth brooders is they come from streams that does allow them to have more motility in where they live in their habitat, because they're not tied to, I need to stay here because it's stagnant and I can build a nest here.
They can pick up their babies and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had to definitely mention the wild type bettas. I actually didn't put one on my list, which was really surprising.
Yeah.
The Unimaculatas is really tempting to put on the list. We have a group of those in the display here as well, and the personality that comes out, everybody gets attracted to that group of Unimaculatas. The other fish that I did put on my list is another dwarf cichlid. Yes, I cheated again. It's the whole genus. But the whole genus of Nanochromis.
That's a good one.
The Perilus, Splendens, Transvestatus, and there's one more, and I'm not thinking of it right now. But that whole genus, they can be treated like an Episto. They can be treated like a ram. We had a pair of those in with our discus for a while.
Yeah.
And they keep such a different space in the tank than the discus do, that they were just fine with discus, which, by the way, I think most of the epistos can be just fine with discus
as long as you can make up for the temperature.
Yes,
as long
yes.
as there's they're one that can take that, and there are a few species in both of, there are at least one species in both of those that can.
Well, most of the wild discus don't come from a habitat that's actually that warm.
Is it easier to keep them in captivity?
Like
a
much
yeah.
easier much easier
it's, easier way. But I know a lot, most European discus breeders are breeding in like 78.
If you want to do both, you could probably split the difference. But if
yeah.
you could find that ideal level for both of them, that would probably be best.
It's well established in the American hobby, but almost nowhere else in the world are they keeping their discus in like 80s, the high 80s.
Interesting.
I don't know what that means or why. It's just no one else really seems to do that.
Well, the Nanochromis genus are really cool, elongated little dwarf cichlids. They do great in planet aquariums. They do want the water to move a little bit more than some of the other dwarf cichlids do. But a pair of Nanochromis can be a great addition to a lot of the planet community tanks that are out there.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because it will prevent me from really cheating and just giving a half of a continent for my next one. Because I seriously thought about just saying all West African cichlids. I think they're all underrated. Nanochromis is a great genus to pull out. That's one I would have mentioned regardless. Pelvicochromis being the most common, and Crebensis are a fantastic fish for a first breeder project, but there are a lot of other Pelvicochromis that are fantastic. So the fish that I decided to single out in that area is one that I just have more of an emotional attachment to, which is the buffalo head cichlid.
Oh, yeah.
And I think of West African cichlids, although this is pretty applicable to all of them, they get a bad rep just for being African cichlids.
True.
They don't come from the Rift Lakes. They come from the rivers that are in completely different countries. So the buffalo head is one I pulled out because I think it looks the most like a Rift Lake cichlid and is the most easily confused for one.
They got that big cool hump head going.
Yeah, they look a lot like a mini Frontosa, and in a way they do have kind of a similar personality to a Frontosa, where they're a lot of all talk and very little bite. But they only get to 4 inches long. They make pretty good community fish as long as you're keeping them with things that both they can't eat and that aren't going to be easily intimidated. The big key to keeping them properly is to give them easily defensible territory to have. And they're really less of a cave spawner and more of a burrower. So a wide mouth cave that they can't really defend, that they would want to go into and hide, often makes them more aggressive. They are keepable in a community. I keep them with my tetras. I keep them with my Kyber's Eye tetras, Betta Una Maculata, and Pearl Daniels. So it's something of a little
bit
of what we've talked to today. The really interesting thing about them is their behaviors. They are definitely a true pair species. Some people claim that they're monogamous, but I think that's probably a little generous. But they do form that true pair bond. So you can see them communicating with each other. You can see them solving issues together. One of my favorite things that I've recorded with mine are they maintain a burrow in my tank, which is basically a pile of rocks and sticks with a ton of soil and plants thrown on top of it. So pretty much their ideal environment, they can burrow into that pile and have separate entrances that they can come in and out of. So I jammed a piece of Anubias into one of their burrow entrances, and I watched my female for like 15 or 20 minutes trying to move that out of there while the male was sort of pacing around and trying to maintain their territory. And he saw what she was doing, and then he rushed over there and grabbed it out of her mouth, ripped it out of the thing, because he's about twice her size, and then was, like, strutting all around, like, trying to convince her to come back to the burrow, because he looked really sexy right about there. And so keeping fish like that, that just have those distinct relationships with each other, is so rewarding, because that's what you see. Those are the types of behaviors that you associate with such bigger animals. They're so small, but you can really observe them in the way that you can really only see otherwise in a wildlife documentary.
I had spent so long trying to breed Betta Una Maculata because I had kept a group of them. And I was so fascinated with the group dynamic that I didn't want to split them up into
right.
their individual pairs, because you could watch females. So in a lot of the mouth brooding species, the females are the dominant ones, and they're the ones that convince the males, hey, you should be with me. You could see some ebb and flow as females manage to get an upper hand on another one and steal each other's boyfriends. And it was so fascinating to watch. But as long as they're capable of doing that, they wouldn't breed for me. So I eventually committed to splitting them up, and then I started getting spawns. But I spent a whole year just like watching them steal each other's boyfriends. And like, you could see a female, she'd lost her boyfriend and then was kind of like, just kind of sulking in the corner. And it was like, and then you could see her pick herself up a few days later and be like, all right, well, I got to start kicking butt now. Like,
That's something I wish was more appreciated in the hobby in general. Just that breeding isn't the only behavior that's fun to observe.
Yeah.
With dynamics, the keeping an active tank where things are sort of interacting with each other a lot, that's a lot of where the joy comes from.
Well, that's why I really like barbs, because
true.
They have a very true hierarchy, and if you watch them, you can pick out who's in charge and what's going on. And theoretically that's happening with stuff like cardinal tetras, but it's much more subtle and much harder to pick out, at least for me.
It depends on how you keep them a little bit too. We really tend to spoil our fish.
Yeah.
So, like, with my group of Daniels, let's say, I keep 12 of them usually at a time. If they were kept in a tank by themselves, they would be spending most of their time foraging, a little of their time sparring. They don't tend to exhibit a lot of different or unique behaviors in a perfect environment. But since I'm keeping them with a benthic species, which is going to prevent them from really just foraging around the bottom as much as they want, I'm keeping them with territorial tetras that are going to keep them out of certain areas. It sort of pushes the fish into a little bit more of a competitive environment where they need to compete a little bit. And while I'm providing the resources that they need to live, in order to be on top, they've got to actually put in an effort in order to be the best one at living in that lifestyle. So that's a fun and rewarding way to look at tanks.
I think we could do a whole talk on cool fish behavior.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to say about it. But yeah, that's why I put the buffalo heads on there, because the only time I've ever seen people keep them is in mixed cichlid tanks, where either they have random South Americans, and they're not really kept for them, they're kept because they're a cichlid. And
well, don't all cichlids go together?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, maybe. But they're never going to show off as well as they could in a tank like that.
Well, at least they're not going to have the ability to display their individual personalities.
Right. They would not find themselves in that environment in the wild.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is turning into a very cool list. I think we've gone all the way around and done 5 for everybody, right?
I thought I went first.
You did. I think you've done 6 now.
Did I do 6?
I think so. Oops. That's all right.
I probably meant to take off one of them.
Cheater.
No.
Well, there were far more than 5 for each of us discussed.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, it was definitely more of a complicated and interesting topic than I thought it was going to be. I thought we would at least have a little bit more crossover than that. I mean, we kind of created a little bit of crossover with some of the ways that we did our lists. But I guess it just goes to show that there are so many amazing, cool fish out there that are underappreciated. Maybe here at Watercolors, we can start to keep getting people excited about some of these rare and harder to find fish.
And let us know what yours are. I feel like everyone who's been in the hobby for a little while has that one fish that they have no idea why it isn't popular. So I'd be interested to hear what other people have to say about that too.
Absolutely. Well, that, and if you're looking for anything in particular, we're always happy to take like suggestions on what to get in.
Please do. We have a pretty limited list of things that we truly love. And there's a lot of overlap between us here. We sort of are drawn to similar types of fish. So I love it when somebody comes in and tells me about that weird Tanganyikan cichlid that they're really excited about and they wish that they could get, and we get to get it for them. Because otherwise, I would never even think about ordering that fish in. But when we get it, I'm sort of glad to experience that and see it. That's what being at a store lets us do. Because otherwise, I'm only getting the fish that I like, and it's probably just going to be a handful in the same categories.
Yeah, I'll be honest. When I look at the list, I skip the Rift Lake cichlid section because I don't know anything about those. So, like, I don't have a foot to stand on when it comes to, well, what's actually cool on this part of the list? Like, I can't make that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I would love to hear from people who do keep peacocks. Like, what is a cool peacock, and why is it cool to you? Because to me, they don't do it for me. Everybody's got that thing that keeps them in it.
Well, on behalf of the Watercolors team here, thank you very much for listening. And in the meantime, keep those hands wet.